chicken or poulard demi de saucisse. Now, you need a fine, fat, roasting chicken like this one. And first, remove the giblets, and you really should save the giblets. They make a fine stock for soup, or you can save the liver and fry it up with some onions for a little snack. Or if you have a number of livers, you can make a lovely liver pate, or perhaps a delicious liverwurst, which you can spread on a cracker, a Ritz cracker, a saltine, or on bread, a rye bread, a pumpernickel bread, or if you're celebrating the Jewish holidays, you can make a chopped liver and shape it into the bust of a friend, someone who's getting married or bar mitzvahed. Oh, is that it? Am I pronouncing it right? A bar mitzvah? I hope so. Or if you have a pet, a cat, or a dog, they love liver, save the liver. Don't throw it away. I hope I've made my point. Don't throw the liver away. Now, where was I? Oh, yes. Poulard demi de saucisse. Now, after you remove the giblets and save the you-know-what, and I mentioned liverwurst, you can spread it on crackers. Oh, well, anyway, it's time to bone the chicken. Now, for this, you need a very sharp knife. Can't do nothing without a sharp knife. Now, you place the chicken on its stomach and cut along the backbone to the Pope's nose like so. Oh! Oh! Now I've done it. I've cut the dickens out of my finger. Well, I'm glad in a way this happened. You know, accidents do happen from time to time in the kitchen. We've never really discussed what to do. First, you must stop the bleeding. The best way is with direct pressure on the apron like so. Now, you want to raise your hand over your head so the blood has to be pumped all the way up. Oh, the apron doesn't seem to be working, so I'd recommend natural coagulants such as chicken liver. Another reason not to throw away the liver. Oh God, it's throbbing. Oh, tourniquet cuts it. Yes, a tourniquet can be made of cheesecloth and a chicken bone. Find a pressure point between the heart and the wound. In this case, the wrist, and cut off the blood. Oh, this is a last resort, however, because you could lose your hand if you tighten it too much. Oh, you're too woozy to tie the tourniquets. Find a call for emergency help. There's not much time left. Now, every kitchen should have the emergency number written on it somewhere. Oh, this one doesn't. 911. Oh, this phone is a prop. It doesn't work. That's a shame because I'm remembering a time when I was a little girl and I had a dog named Amber. I used to give him liver. And my mother gave me a doll. Why are you all spinning? Well, I think I'm going to go to sleep now. Bon appetit.
Des yeux qui font baisser les miens, un rire qui se perd sur sa bouche, voilà le portrait sans retouche de l'homme auquel j'appartiens. Quand il me prend dans ses bras, il me parle tout bas, je vois la vie en rose. Il me dit des mots d'amour, des mots de tous les jours, que ça me fait quelque chose. Il est entré dans mon cœur une part de bonheur dont je connais la cause. C'est lui pour moi, moi pour lui dans la vie. Il me l'a dit, l'a juré pour la vie.
Hey everyone, welcome back to My Life as a Foodie. I'm going off the reservation a little today with this episode. It's going to be one single-lane highway. We're just talking about one thing. Saturday, August 15th, is Julia Child's birthday. And I can tell you, without a doubt in my mind, and I'm sure in yours, that I wouldn't be sitting here today talking about food and cooking if it were not for Julia Child. The world of home cooks, celebrity chefs, French food, Top Chef, the Food Network, Tony Bourdain, No Reservations, a multitude of cookbooks on French food and French cooking, Ratatouille, Remy the Rat, Ad Hoc, The French Laundry, Thomas Keller. If you ask me, a lot of this would not be here if it weren't for Julia Child. I mean, it may have happened, but I think a lot of the influence has come for a lot of this from Julia Child. If you want my honest opinion, that's how I feel. So on this day, I feel it only right that I stop being crass and snarky and angry for one episode and celebrate the woman who showed everybody that they too can cook French food at home and bring your family together to enjoy a delicious, healthy, home-cooked meal every day of the week. And I'm not sure if you've seen Julie and Julia yet, but it's in theaters now. And half of it is based on Julia's book, My Life in France, which covered how she came to be one of the most respected food writers in the history of food writing. How living in France kind of opened her eyes to food, how wonderful ingredients can be, and kind of decoded the mystery of French cooking and breaking it down so everybody here in America and everywhere else in the world, really, can cook classic French food at home. I mean, it was a gift from Julia to us, and she worked really hard to do that. I finished her book, My Life in France, and I was kind of inspired to say something. And seeing that it was her birthday, I thought it was only right that I dedicate a show to her. So today I want to talk about her. I want to talk about her life, what she did, how she got there, share some highlights from her career, and cook a dish from her book, The French Chef. Cook it with you, and we'll pair it with a nice beer, not a wine, because, you know, we might be doing a little different show today, but it doesn't mean that we have to lose our freaking minds and start drinking wine, you know? So, Chimay, it's going to be, because it's Belgian, but it's kind of French. And because the show is all about Julia, I'm not going to mention things I would normally talk about. I'm not going to mention the terrorism to children that PETA inflicted last week when they stood outside of a McDonald's in New York and passed out unhappy meals. These boxes contained bloodied rubber chicken, a packet of ketchup blood, a McCruelty t-shirt wrapped in a blood-splattered chicken sandwich box, and a cardboard cutout of Ronald McDonald, looking like he's possessed by a chicken devil holding a big OJ knife. Terrifying. For children, mind you. I'm not going to talk about that. I'm not going to talk about the Twitter war that I got into with the official PETA. I posted a link to the story, this story about McCruelty, and I said I thought it was going too far. And this asshole has the audacity to say that they got a lot of positive feedback from parents on McCruelty. So I said, yeah, I'd like to see some of that feedback, if you don't mind. I mean, I agree McDonald's is evil, but it's kind of heavy-handed, don't you think, you know, for kids? You scare the shit out of them. So, eventually, no response back. To each his own, I'm told. But I'm not going to talk about that. I'm not going to bring that stuff up. Because this show is not about food issues, and I promise to be nice. So we're just going to talk about Julia Child today, okay? And I'm glad I've decided to do this, because there are some things about Julia Child that even I didn't know. Like, she loved McDonald's French fries before they went all healthy.
I like McDonald's. I think they're very careful, and I think if they have a, you know, you buy a franchise, I think you only have a certain amount so that you're in charge and they have their standards and so forth. And I thought when they first started out, the French fries were very good. And then the nutritionists got at them that which turned out to be erroneous, that beef tallow fat was bad and that lard was bad and so forth. And so they changed it to some kind of a nutritionist oil. And they've been kind of limp ever since. I never really eat them, which is too bad. And I always am very strong about criticizing it, hoping maybe they'll change.
I can't remember where I saw it. Maybe it was in Food Inc., but when McDonald's first started, back in the 50s, they were a regular hamburger stand. They made regular food. They made it quickly. And they started calling it fast food because it was fast. And it wasn't the money-making machine that they are today. They were like In-N-Out or a small Midwest chain. They're just making quick food, hamburgers and French fries. But then they started maximizing their dollars by hiring people to just do one thing. You know, you grill burgers, you put the mustard and ketchup on, and then you put them in the bun, and then you over there, you wrap them, and you put them under these lights. That's how they maximized their dollar. So yeah, I imagine back then, they were using real animal fat to cook their fries. And they were probably delicious. You know, Bourdain went to Chicago, went to this place that cooked frites in duck fat. And he said they were fantastic, crispy, and delicious. So, you know, I wouldn't blame it on them going healthy, though. Julia, that's madness. McDonald's healthy. Julia Child's maiden name was actually Julia McWilliams. And she would be 97 years old today. She passed away 5 years ago. And I remember this tribute that Food Network put together for her, and it stuck with me. Because I remember when I was a little kid, my mom would watch her program on PBS, and she was really entertaining to watch. She really was. She had this funny way of talking, and she was really loose in front of the camera. Not like today. You know, most of the people today act completely different in front of the camera than they do in real life. With Julia, you just got Julia. And she drank, too. I mean, she was never afraid to hit the bottle, ever. If it went in her food, a little bit of it, you know, found its way into her glass. So you gotta love that. And of course, you know, as a kid seeing this, it made me want to cook. And I think I wanted to cook, and I thought about this. I wanted to cook because I knew it was something that my mom didn't really like to do back then. She did it because she had to feed us. But she didn't like to do it. She was busy. She was working. She was worried where our next paycheck was going to come from. And she was always worried for our safety. So I think most of the reason why she didn't cook, she just didn't have time. I mean, she loved to eat. She loved food. She really did love food. But cooking was time consuming. So I thought if I could get good at it, then I could help out. And I can't tell you why, but Mom would never have any of that. She wouldn't have me in a kitchen. She didn't want me there. She'd say the kitchen was no place for boys. And I wasn't sure if that meant she didn't want me to burn or cut myself in the kitchen, or if she was just afraid that if I cooked and I spent time in the kitchen, it would turn me into an effeminate little kid. Because back then, the kitchen was for women. It wasn't for boys. And maybe if I was older, it would have been different. But I'll tell you, it certainly couldn't have been the cutting myself or burning myself part. Because let me tell you something. I cut and burned myself plenty when I was a kid. A week didn't pass where I wasn't bruised, bleeding, or burned in some way. I got into a lot of shit when I was a kid. So much trouble, I think the kitchen probably would have been a safer place for me. But no, I think it was my infatuation, not only with Julia Child, but the Galloping Gourmet, that turned my mother off to the idea. Graham Kerr was his name. That dude used to drink a whole bottle of wine. He'd get hammered on his show. He would just get blitzed. And she said, you know, you're a young boy, you should be out playing sports. Which I did, by the way. But gourmet, that was out of the question. And galloping was out of the question. Now, in the town where I was growing up, you put galloping and gourmet together, and that's an express train to an ass-kicking. It was a tough town where I grew up. Neighborhood beatings were handed out daily. I got those, too. So, an 8-year-old galloping gourmet for a son probably would have made my mother's already tough life a little bit tougher. So, I understood. And I understand today. I don't hold it against her in any way. I'm just happy that I'm able to do what I'm able to do today as a home chef in the kitchen. And it was both Julia Child and the Galloping Gourmet that influenced every step I take in the kitchen today at home. And a lot of people feel this way. I'm not alone here. When Julia was in her 20s, she volunteered with the American Red Cross. And then when Japan bombed Pearl Harbor in 1941, she tried to join the Navy. But get this, the Navy turns her down because she was too tall. 6'2", this woman was 6'2". Holy crap. That's tall. And they wouldn't let her in. So instead, she joins the Office of Strategic Services, better known as the OSS. And the OSS was actually the CIA before the CIA was the CIA. She was a spy. Julia was a spy during World War II. And this report came out a couple years ago, and believe me, I was shocked. It was even mentioned in an episode of No Reservations.
It's nice to have something a little bit unusual in the way of vegetables.
Julia Child always looked for the unusual in her cooking.
Unusual ways of doing the usual.
Now we've discovered her very unusual, very secretive past. In these files, declassified today by the U.S. Archives,
Julia McWilliams.
The file of Julia McWilliams, her maiden name, was revealed to the world. It showed the woman known as the French chef was really a spy in her younger years. During World War II, she served an international spy ring run by the Office of Strategic Services, an early version of the CIA.
This is her resume.
McWilliams at the time had worked at a furniture store in Beverly Hills, but was fired. She had to write this handwritten note explaining what happened.
I made a tactical error and was out. However, I learned a lot about store and business politics, a great deal about advertising, and wish I had been older and more experienced.
Child was hired and stationed in China making $2,600 a year to spy for the U.S. She met her future husband, Paul Child, moved to France, and the rest was history.
While she was in France, she met her co-author of the French Chef, and they decided to write a book, and that's how she became a chef.
So after the war was over, she moves to Washington, D.C., and she meets and marries her husband, Paul Child. And he joined the U.S. Foreign Service and then moved them both to Paris in 1949 after he was assigned to be an exhibits officer with the U.S. Information Agency there. It seemed like government had a lot of agencies that they don't have anymore, or they were just called something else and became, you know, another agency. But back then, there were a lot like that. I mean, the book is full of them. So her husband, Paul, was apparently a real foodie. I mean, this guy was a gourmand. He loved good food. He introduced her to fine cuisine and was kind of responsible for introducing her to this whole new world of food. So, literally, if there was no Paul Child, we'd have no Julia Child. And then one night, in the town of Rouen, France, which is the capital of Normandy, she has a meal that consisted of oysters, Dover sole, and a whole lot of wine. And she said that was the meal that turned her into a gourmet food junkie. Those are my words. Of course, she didn't say that. I said gourmet food junkie. She wrote eloquently. Her book, My Life in France, read a lot like Katrina's aunt's book that she wrote about her first 80 years. And I think that's why I loved reading Julia's book as much as I did. Well, for one thing, I've been reading a lot of crap. I mean, I was reading Cormac McCarthy. This guy wrote the most violent stuff. No Country for Old Men, and then Blood Meridian, which was extremely violent. And they're supposed to be making that into a movie. Todd Field. He directed In the Bedroom, and then he did the other one, Little Children. That guy's kind of fucked up. Anyway, but he's going to make a movie out of this. I'm like, oh, Doug, please don't. It's just a bloodbath. Anyway, I needed something light and airy to read, so I read this. It's like a 180 reversal. So now I'm back to reading violent things. But yeah, she was older than Katrina's aunt. But people from that era, just they talked differently. They wrote differently. They lived differently. And I loved our aunt very much, so reading Julia's book reminded me of her, so it was kind of nice. So, of course, with Paul working in Paris, and her really having nothing to do with her time, she decides to go to cooking school. Le Cordon Bleu, maybe you heard of it. And she wasn't immediately accepted there, of course, because she's American. And French didn't care for Americans much. And I wonder if they still do. You know, back then, they didn't think that Americans had the palate required to appreciate French food. But they didn't have a choice about accepting Julia. She was there. They had to deal with it. And then she later joins a cooking club for women. And she met Simone Beck, who was working on a French cookbook for Americans with another friend of hers. And then she asks Julia if she'd like to help her with the book, seeing that she's American. And so Julia said, yeah, I'll help you. And it turns out the cookbook was just, at first it was nothing but a bunch of recipes. And the editor sees it and he goes, listen, you know, as a recipe book for French food, this is great. But as a cookbook for Americans to learn how to cook French food, this sucks. There's no anecdotes. There's nothing that appeals to Americans. It's really dry, of course, because it's French. You put some humor in it or something. Do anything. And then I go, well, get that crazy tall American chick that you know that loves our food so much. Have her help you. But do something. Fix this, because now we can't publish it like this. So this book, it went through hell. So anyway, she starts working on the book, and in 1951, they start teaching cooking classes in Julia's home kitchen to American women. And during all this, they continue to work on the French recipes. They test, they write, they edit the recipes, they translate the French recipes to English, they punch them up with some stories, and make them appealing to Americans. And one of the most interesting things in her book was a situation that came up where they'd sent this recipe to their editor to try at home. And of course, there's pictures of the recipe, right? And they were sensitive about everything. Everything was secret, like top secret written on every page. Don't let any of your friends see this. This is for your eyes only. Only do this in your kitchen. Of course, you know, what does the editor do? She gives a recipe to her friend to try in the kitchen. She says, can you try this? Let me know how it turns out. So Julia finds out. She's like, dude, what the hell? I told you this was top secret. What part of don't show this to anybody don't you understand in this letter I sent you? And she was pissed. Anyway, they worked on the book for like 10 years, and they finally got enough recipes together to compose this book, French Cooking for the American Kitchen. And during all this, things with the U.S. Information Service started to fall down a little bit. I don't know how many of my listeners I have who know much about our country's history, or maybe we're even around, but I'm just going to say this. The McCarthy era, if you know what I'm talking about, was beginning to take its toll on Paul Child and his job. And they really started to wonder how much longer they'd be able to live in France because Paul might lose his job. They might not be there anymore. Now, back then, if our government thought you might be a communist, you had to go in front of a panel and answer a bunch of questions to prove that you weren't a communist. If they thought you were, you had to answer questions. It was horrible. Especially if you worked for the government, because they really couldn't have a communist working in the government. So any day they could have been, you know, questioning Paul. So you pussies who think we have it tough when the internet goes down, or your cell phone's in a dead zone, or Facebook isn't working, or, oh, I can't tweet. You know, try living through the McCarthy era, okay? It sucked. So anyway, they get the book French Cooking for the American Kitchen to a publisher, but it gets rejected because they said it read like an encyclopedia, and it was too long. They wanted it chopped into pieces. And they went back and forth for years. Finally, her friend Avis sends the book off to Knopf Publishing without telling her and says, can you take a look at this? And of course, later they got upset. Well, what the hell are you doing? But no, it worked out because Knopf Publishing loved it. And they want to publish it. And they said they do everything. They print it. And they said that book would do for French cooking in America what The Joy of Cooking did for just regular cooking in general. But they hated the title. They didn't like the title that they chose, French Cooking in the French Cooking for the American Kitchen. So they went back and forth on a name, and this lasted a long time. They finally settled on Mastering the Art of French Cooking. And so it was. It got published, and it went on to be this, you know, famous book. So in 1962, Julia appears on WGBH, which was a PBS type of station. And she was plugging her book, and she decides while she's plugging the book, she's going to demonstrate on the show how to properly cook an omelet. And they say if you're a chef, a true chef, you can cook an egg. That's the true sign. If they want to test somebody, see how they cook, have them cook an egg. Because it's really not that easy to cook it perfectly. It takes a real chef to do it. So she's going to cook this omelet, and she does this demonstration. People love that segment so much. The station got all this feedback, and they immediately wanted to give her a show of her own. So they did. In 1963, her show, The French Chef, debuted on WGBH, and it was a smash hit. It won Emmys like a freight train. It was on television for 10 years. And Julia Child was a household name after that. She wasn't the first person to cook on TV, but she was certainly the most widely known person. And another favorite book of hers that I own is called The French Chef Cookbook. We're going to cook from this. And it's another book that I recommend if you're a fan of Julia Child and you're a fan of French cooking, you should own it. It's a collection of recipes from the 10 years that her show, The French Chef, was on. If you buy this book, you really won't need another French cookbook. I mean, it's important that you have the other ones, but this one is kind of killer. The meals are really easy. They're simple, really well documented. It's got little stories, you know, in there that, you know, that made Julia popular. So she continues on TV with a lot of these shows in the 70s anyway. And through the 80s, she had collaborations with Jacques Pepin, who was a pastry chef. A lot of these can be seen on YouTube, pbs.org. You can look them up. If you want to see the French Chef episodes, they have them all up there. It's magic. So you can take a look at that. It's something you couldn't do years ago. So she loses Paul in 1994. He'd been ill for a while, had a bunch of strokes, and spent his last years in a nursing home. And she moved to Santa Barbara at the turn of the century here. And she lived there until her death in 2004. Julia passed from kidney failure in an assisted living home in Montecito on August 13th. Now, she had great reverence, not only for French food and cooking, but for food itself. I mean, she defined the word foodie to me. To me, she defined the word chef. Her love of food and cookbooks transcended my passion more than I'll ever have. You know, she saw cookbooks in history as a keyhole into the past because cookbooks leave you clues about what life was like back then. You know, take her cookbook, for example. Look at these recipes in this book. And then you can kind of see what was available in the 50s and 60s and how much of that food isn't available anymore. Or maybe it's called something else now. She loved food and recipes, but most of all, Julia, she loved cookbooks.
This was Jefferson's favorite recipe for ice cream. 2 bottles of cream and 5 egg yolks and so forth. When he went over to Paris, he took his cook over with him because he was very much interested in good food, and he wrote down in his own hand a great many good French recipes that he liked. And then he asked the various chefs to help his cook and give him some pointers. From then on, he would never be without a French chef. You know, you never know what you're going to find when you start browsing among these old cookbooks. You know, what's fascinating about these books, this is 1738, but it gives you a real idea of what people were eating and doing and how they lived, what they grew in their gardens, what they did for entertainment. The view of history that we get through the kitchen window is a more gentle view, not of war and politics, but of family and community and sharing. The earliest cookbook in the Library of Congress collection was in the 1400s, and I think the Italians were the masters of cooking at that point, but still things were rather in a chaotic state and nothing much had been written down. But the library has the very first French cookbook, Le Cuisinier François, and when the French came into it seriously, they began making order out of chaos. The French set a standard for cookbooks. They were the first to establish the order of ingredients, the units of measure, and many of the cooking techniques that are familiar today. Now, here's a wonderful little book. This is a French one from the 18th century. Le Festin Joyeux, or La Cuisine en Musique, as the author says, is written to so that Madame can teach her underlings how to remember the recipes of the household, so that you have all the recipes in here, and then each one has the name of the tune, and then you look back, and there is the music. And it really is a good way of remembering recipes. It's just as though you said, now maybe that's a good idea. Perhaps I should have a singing cookbook for my next one.
Okay, so let's cook something, man, because I'm starving. In the summer, I like to grill. You know, I like to eat things like salads, light things, you know, tomatoes, cucumbers, and cold soups like gazpacho and cold beet soup. You know, we made that one last year on the Halloween show. Blood of Dracula soup is cold beet soup. Delicious. One of my all-time favorite cold soups is vichyssoise, which is leek and potato soup. There are many reasons why I like this soup. Number one, it's really simple to make. It's quick and it's simple. Number two, it's incredibly healthy. It uses vegetables and either water or stock and a little bit of butter and a tiny bit of cream. And number three, it's versatile. If you make it in the summer, you know, you serve it cold. Make it in the fall, in winter, and it's a hot potato and leek soup. And I think it's even more delicious warm. We end up eating it more in the fall and winter than we do in the summer, because we like to eat it warm. But in the summer, it's vichyssoise. Now, Julia made a leek and potato soup on her soup show, which was the 51st episode of The French Chef. And her recipe for it appears on page 119 of her French Chef cookbook, which you can buy on Amazon.com. Like I said, it's really one of the only French cookbooks you'll really ever need. Mastering the Art of French Cooking Volumes 1 and 2 are the Bible. But this is more of a somewhat condensed version with an equal amount of detail in each recipe. I'm going to give you the recipe for leek and potato soup from the French Chef cookbook. Her book actually has several variations of how to do the soup, and I prefer vichyssoise, and I do things slightly differently than her recipe says. Same ingredients, but slightly different in the procedures that I use. So here's how we're going to do this. First, we're going to need a 3 to 4 quart saucepan to cook the soup in. And next, we're going to take some leeks here, and we're going to use only the white parts. You don't want any of the green part of the leek in your soup. The soup should be white, so only the white parts. We're going to need 3 cups of thinly sliced leeks. So we're going to chop these up. That. Now listen, leeks grow underground, okay? So they're dirty as hell. And because they hide a lot of dirt, you want to make sure that you rinse them really well. So we're going to put them in a colander. All right, we're going to spray them down with water. Now, better yet, if you have one, rinse them in a big bowl. And then put the leeks in a salad spinner and then spin the excess water and dirt off of them if you have one of those. Okay, so those are done. And now we're going to toss them in a large bowl. And we're going to move on to our potatoes. Now, we need 3 cups of diced potatoes, any potatoes really, but I like to use russets for this. Just make sure the potatoes peeled clean of any skin. Make sure the potatoes rinsed. And then chop that into a dice. Now, any size will do. It doesn't have to be perfect because it's going to end up being blended. And we need 3 cups of that chopped potato. Now, add those in the bowl with the leeks. And now we're going to have the heat. We have a heat on the saucepan here, medium-high. And we've had it on for about 2 minutes. And then when you start to see that it's getting warm, we're going to add 3 tablespoons of softened and salted butter. And we're going to melt the butter in the saucepan. Now, when the butter's fully melted, you want to add your cleaned and chopped leeks and the potatoes into the saucepan. Throw in a bay leaf. Now, we're going to sauté the vegetables in butter for about 6 minutes, or until the leeks get really wilted. You want to keep stirring the vegetables, okay? Listen, you got to keep stirring, because if you get any color on the veggies, the soup is not going to be white, all right? If the vegetables start to take on any color, you know, you want to turn the heat down to medium or low. Now, when the leeks are wilted, add 4 cups of water and 4 cups of chicken stock to the pot, and then bring the soup to a simmer. Listen, if you don't have chicken stock, you can use chicken bouillon and water. Julie's recipe for vichyssoise calls for half water and half stock. So if you just want to make regular leek and potato soup, it's just all water, so you can do that. But vichyssoise has more punch, so the chicken stock or bouillon really kind of helps the flavor. Punches it up a little bit. All right, so anyway, simmer the vegetables on low to medium heat for about 25 minutes until the potatoes are nice and tender, and then turn off the heat, let the soup cool down a little bit, about, you know, 30 minutes to an hour, and when it's cooled down, I'm going to fish out that bay leaf, and we're going to throw it away. All right, next we're going to grab a blender. We're going to start scooping that soup into the blender. You want to fill the blender about halfway with the soup. Make sure you got plenty of the potatoes and the leeks and the liquid. And put a top on the top of the blender. Put a towel over it. And now we're going to blend the soup until it's smooth. Now listen, let me stop. Keep your hand on the soup, on top of the blender. All right, keep your hand on top here. Keep the towel over it. Even if the soup is slightly cooled, even if it's relatively hot, and some of that stuff hits you in the face, you're going to wish you were dead. Believe me, there's nothing nastier than hot soup in the face. All right, so we'll continue to blend the soup in batches here. All right, now we'll empty the blended soup in a large clean saucepan that we're going to be reheating in a second. And when it's all blended, I'm going to turn the saucepan full of blended smooth soup over medium heat, and we're going to add 1/8 teaspoon of nutmeg, preferably fresh grated nutmeg if you have that. Mix it in really nice, and the minute you start to see small bubbles rising to the top of the soup, you can do one of two things. You can add 1/3 cup of heavy cream, blend it in, then turn the soup off. Or if you prefer not to add the cream, you can turn the soup off right now. You don't have to have cream in it if you don't want, but classic vichyssoise has cream. It's your choice, but sometimes I like the cream in there, sometimes I don't. It doesn't matter. Whatever you like. Now cover the soup, allow it to cool down completely, and then put the saucepan full of soup in the fridge until it's completely chilled. Now this can take up to 4 to 5 hours, depending on how hot it got. But if you want to make this the day before, that's fine. This is one of those soups actually tastes really good the next day. You know, it really works. So to serve, just pull the soup out of the fridge, serve it in small soup bowls, top it with some chopped chives on top, maybe a dollop of sour cream if you want, and that's the soup. It goes really well with some fresh bread and a glass of Chimay 5 Cents. And that's Chimay's white beer, or their triple. It's spicy, it's fruity, it's perfectly dominant on its own, but it's a real palate pleaser when you pair it with this soup. It says summer to me. The vichyssoise paired with Chimay's triple will cool you down and fill you up. And you put little bread and you're done. Trust me. Now, Belgians are somewhat French. I started to talk about this earlier. You know, the Belgians, maybe they don't want to be French, but there's some French there. Okay, so Chimay Triple only seems appropriate to pair with this food. If you're not going to do wine, yeah, some light Belgian beer would be perfect. It really is. It's a great pairing. I know the Belgians fight it. Ah, we're Flemish. We're not French. Dude, listen, you sound French. You look French. The French have been here, apparently. Well, but we're not French. Yes, you are. Don't fight it. It's a good thing, man. Got a little French influence. It's fine. And as Julia said, bon appetit. Enjoy yourself. Listen, that's it for me. That's all I have. I want to thank you for celebrating Julia's birthday with me, for following along. And listen, check the links on the website. Buy her cookbooks on Amazon.com. Now, you can't live without these books. If you're into French food, French cuisine, or interested in seeing how Julia changed the world of food TV and the American kitchen, yeah, buy the books. They're not that expensive. In fact, I think it just shot up to number one on the bestseller list because of the movie. And listen, and speaking of the movie, Julie and Julia, it's in theaters now. It's getting mixed reviews, of course, but it's, you know, it's got Meryl Streep in it. It's perfect. Celebrates the life of Julia Child. And Meryl Streep, you know, I was in Total Wine recently. I was speaking to this guy, Eric Vallis. I think I've seen pronounced his name. Eric Vallis or Eric Vales. Anyway, he works in the wine department at Total Wine & More. They're in Tustin. The store I shop at is in Tustin. If you guys shop at BevMo and there's a Total Wine & More within shopping distance or within driving distance, TotalWine.com. Check your local listings. Maybe there's one near you. I swear to God, Total Wine make BevMo look like 7-Eleven. It's a lot cheaper, bigger selection, nicer, and they don't mistreat beer. Okay, they've got coolers. Some, you know, some stuff's on shelves, but it's kept dark, not light. Like you go into BevMo and it looks like, you know, you're in this on the sun, and it's a much better place. Anyway, I'm talking to this guy, Eric, and we're talking about Meryl Streep, and I said, listen. I said, you know, Julia Child, Meryl Streep can save any movie. She could star in a movie about poop, and it'll be the best movie about poop ever made. So I'll talk about Total Wine in another episode. MyRecipes.com, I still need to get to that. I've been pimping like crazy. Anyway, music in this episode from Edith Piaf. If you like the song, you can download it from the iTunes store. You can check the link on our website for more details, MyLifeAsAFoodie.com. Hey, listen, my name is Phil. This has been My Life as a Foodie. And in the words of Julia Child, bonjour!